Just look at y'all so happy and clappy this morning. Nice. Happy holidays. Just a great time to be here. Great time to preach from the Word of God. And the theme today, I think you'll like it. It just sort of fits the Christmas spirit, as does the book of Ruth in general. I'm going to be reading from Luke, the third chapter. Ruth. Did I say Luke twice? How many times did I say Luke? Ruth is what I mean. The third chapter, I won't have it on the PowerPoint, so you'll want to have a Bible open in your lap on your phone or in paper or whatever you have. In fact, I just want to challenge you the next few weeks, maybe longer, bring a Bible. If you're sitting next to somebody who obviously didn't think to bring one, or maybe they're a guest, or even when I say Ruth 3, maybe they don't exactly know how to find Ruth. Just be a good neighbor and say, here, you want to look at mine with me and open yours and share it with them. And that way we all have the Word of God open in front of us. I do want you to know that all of our campuses today, we have available these notes that I promised to get to you from the sermon series I called Legion. So it's about, I think, close to 50 pages worth of notes. And we went on and printed them color because we had some graphs and all in there. And it cost North Boulevard about $6 a piece to print them. So if you don't mind giving $6 when you pick up a copy, if you want to pick up a copy. But if that's a hardship or you just don't want to pay for it, but you still want a copy, go on and take one, no problem with us. We just didn't budget the money for it and want to make sure that we're responsible with our money. If you don't want one at all, join the club. I bet there's others. Hey, to start us by thinking about what the subject matter is from Ruth 3, we go back to 1789 when one woman named Lucy Hanks was on trial in Mercer County, Kentucky for the crime of, get ready for this, fornication. Because it was actually illegal in Mercer County, Kentucky back then. Seems she had had a daughter out of wedlock, took a little bit of time before charges were brought to her, brought against her. She was scheduled for a trial, and just before the trial occurred, a local farmer, a well-to-do farmer who had a really good reputation there in Mercer County, married her in order to save her the humiliation and the obvious penalties that would ensue from that trial for fornication. She married him, had a pretty good life, and in a lot of ways, all of us should be grateful that this man married her, because her grandson turned out to be none other than Abraham Lincoln, who often referred to the fact that he had a lot of illegitimate people in his lineage and that God had somehow redeemed that every step of the way. It's that word redemption that I want to think about. God has called a lot of things in the Bible. We're used to the titles of Christ or the titles of God in the Bible, and a lot of them, and they're powerful, wonderful, great. I think someone has counted more than 60 titles of God in the Scriptures. One of the titles that is used of God that I think maybe is a little lost on today's generation is the title Redeemer. Let me just show you a few texts where God's redemptive work is shown. Exodus 6 and verse 6, very beautiful text. God promises Moses and the Israelites that he would redeem them from their bondage in Egypt. And he says, I will redeem you with an outstretched arm, a statement of strength, and with mighty acts of judgment. Isaiah talks about God as a redeemer more than any other writer. And here's just one of his texts where he teaches us not to be afraid, because God himself will help us, the Lord, the Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. And in the New Testament, we're reminded that our ultimate redemption was provided for us in the death of Christ, that Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law. Not that the law was a curse. The curse of the law was the fact that none of us could live up to it. So we were all cursed because we were all disobedient. Christ saved us from our own disobedience then, by being hung on the cross in our stead. And Peter puts it in this beautiful language here in 1 Peter 1, that we were redeemed not with perishable things like silver and gold, but we were redeemed with the precious blood of Christ, who is a lamb without blemish or defect. So the word redeem simply means to buy something back. That's kind of important in the Bible, that we understand this principle, that redeeming in the Bible is paying the price of getting something restored or getting it back. It's a word that was commonly used 30, 40, 50 years ago. In fact, some of you who are older will remember these, S&H, also known as green stamps. I knew the word redemption because Mama used to collect green stamps. So this was one of the first loyalty programs in American history where what you would do is you would go down to a grocery store, or maybe a hardware store, and for every dollar you spent, you would get a stamp or two from that store. And then you take the stamp and you put it in a book. Here's a copy of an idea book, the S&H Green Stamp book. And then when you got a certain number of books, you could go to a store called a redemption store. Now, we would often think that we were redeeming something, but that's not exactly the case. The company, S&H, was redeeming their stamps. They were buying back their stamps from you, the customer, by giving you one of these swank prizes here. In fact, I say that because about half of them have the word swank in the description. So, for example, you can get this number 6 swank money clip, that's what it says, for only one book. And the Zippo is only a book and 3/4, which I think is a really good price on a Zippo. The idea of redemption is simply buying something back. But in the Bible, it becomes a really rich spiritual term. In the Bible, it's not just economics. In the Bible, redemption is a spiritual process in addition to economics. In the Bible, redemption is being willing to pay the price to make something or someone whole again. This is really important. In fact, it's important enough that I feel inadequate. So I preached the first sermon an hour or so ago, 8 o'clock, whatever time it was. That's a little more than an hour ago. And I thought when I went into the sermon, you know, I've kind of got the whole thing summed up really well. And when the sermon was over with, I thought it wasn't a bad sermon, but I just don't think I really connected on how important this concept is. That someone was willing to buy me out of my enslavement to the demonic world of sin. I could not get out of it. I did not have enough to pay the price to get me out. God did. And he redeemed me. And once I realized that's what God did for me, the mandate, what I really want each of us to take from this lesson is not just the appreciation that God would redeem us, but that imperative that says, okay, in my marriage, with my neighbors or the people I work with or my estranged parents or my estranged brothers or sisters, I have an obligation but also a privilege of redeeming that situation, of paying the price in a broken situation to bring about wholeness once again. So it's an Old Testament concept. Let me just show you a few times that redemption is mentioned. Leviticus 25. In fact, if you look at Leviticus 25, the whole chapter is on redemption, various laws about redemption. Here's one. If you buy a house in a city, you have a whole year within which you can redeem it if you have a change of mind. You couldn't do it out in the country because people depended upon the property once they bought it for their livelihood, but not so in the city. Here again in Leviticus 25, if you have a neighbor, or a family member, sometimes the word neighbor, by the way, in the Old Testament can mean family member, and sometimes it can mean just someone living next to you. But let's say you have a family member who loses all their money and has to sell all their property. Under the Old Testament law, you are obligated to buy their property and hold it in escrow for when they got their money back and when they got back on their feet, they could buy it back from you. That way the property didn't leave the family and go off into the open market and you never see it again. What I want you to see is that God cares. He cares about our well-being, and he makes provision for the disasters that befall us in life. Here's another example. God makes it clear that every firstborn among our flocks, as well as in our family, every firstborn belongs to God. But he says, you can have him back, but you got to buy it back. So if you have, for example, in this text, if your firstborn donkey, you have to redeem him. He belongs to God. And if you're not willing to redeem him, you got to kill him. Because that's God's donkey. Even though it was born in your herd. Is that right? A herd of donkeys? I don't know what you'd call it. A pack? A flock? Whatever it is. Even though it was born to you, the first one belongs to God. And you have to buy it back from God. And that's also true with your own son. You may think your first son is your prize and your joy, but actually your first son belongs to God, and God says you have to buy him back from me. Redemption was a big deal in the Old Testament. I mentioned that as one of the most important words in the book of Ruth. 22 times this word redemption appears in the book of Ruth. In fact, you really can say that in addition to grace, kindness, if you will, faithfulness, the driving ethic of the book of Ruth is redemption. It's a word that appears in Ruth so many times. This is a chart showing how many times the Hebrew word appears. Watch this. Of the 1,823 words in the book of Ruth, literally 22 or 1.2% are the word redemption. I'm just showing you it's a very important term in the book of Ruth. This idea of being willing to pay the price to make someone or something whole again. That's the story of Ruth, the third chapter. Boaz decides to pay the price to make Naomi and Ruth's lives whole again. You remember what happened? Naomi is married to a man named Elimelech. They live in a place called Bethlehem, which means house of bread. But this time, the house of bread has a famine. And so Elimelech and his wife Naomi move over across the Dead Sea to Moab. There, their two sons marry Moabite women, and then tragedy strikes. All three men die. In the ancient world, to have no men to provide for you or protect you was a disaster. So as Naomi prepares to move back to Bethlehem, only Ruth comes with her and swears allegiance to Naomi. Ruth goes out to glean in a field, that is to pick up the remains of a harvested field, and it just so happens that she ends up in the field of Boaz, who is a near kinsman to the family of Elimelech. And so in chapter 3, Naomi comes up with a plan for how she can get Ruth married to none other than Boaz. If Boaz does this, he's redeeming the whole family. That is, he's going to pay the price to make sure these two women are made whole again for life. You're going to see it in the book of Ruth. God is a redeemer. And what I want you to take home from this book is that we're to be a redeemer as well. All right, so let's jump into the book of Ruth, chapter 3. We'll read a bit. Now, I have just an illustration or two, and I'll be done. One day, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, "My daughter, I must find a home for you where you will be well provided for." Verse 2. "Now, Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash, put on perfume, and get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you're there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he's lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do." "I will do whatever you say," Ruth answered. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law had told her to do. So we're at the end of the barley harvest. Here's how it worked. When the men harvested the fields, they would immediately take it to a flat place, usually on top of a hill. It would be a rock if they could find a slab. They would spread all of the grain and the still on the stalk on top of the rock, and then they would get a donkey or maybe a horse or maybe even an ox, and they would tie a sled to it, a wooden sled, a heavy sled. They may even have a child sit on the sled, and then the ox would walk circles over the stalks, and as it would do that, the friction against the stalk would separate the chaff from the actual grain. Then in the evening, because places like Bethlehem are on the tops of mountains, there was always a breeze. They would take a winnowing fork and they would throw it up in the air. The breeze would blow the chaff away and the grain would fall to the ground. Now, you didn't want to leave all your grain unguarded. So the men would always spend the night on the winnowing floors, even if it took a couple of weeks. Sometimes they would build what the older people would call an arbor. They would use some of the stalks just to sort of build a shack. That's probably a better word for us. Just a temporary shack. They would sleep there. They would celebrate because with the harvest, you knew you were going to have food. So what Naomi says to Ruth is they're going to be down there in their shack tonight. Boaz is one of our near kinsmen. He's a candidate for redeeming us from our broken situation. After nightfall, when everybody's had plenty to drink and eat, and they're all lying down to sleep, I want you to go and I want you to lie at his feet and he'll tell you what to do. Let me say a couple of things about this principle of lying at his feet. There's several indications in the Old Testament that this was not an uncommon practice for women to indicate their availability to men. We shouldn't take it as a sexual thing or as a sinful thing. It is simply some sort of honorific way of saying, will you redeem me? I want to point that out. The whole world of Ruth is a strange world to us. And as I preach it and I get some feedback from you, I'm just reminded of how much of an imagination it takes for us. It takes some imagination for us to appreciate what's happening in the book of Ruth. You have to imagine, in order to appreciate this, imagine a world where there are no police. There are zero police. So if you have a crime, you're all on your own. There is no police force. Imagine a world where there's no kind of social security. There is nothing like welfare, nothing like that at all. If a spouse dies, you starve. Imagine a world where even the streets aren't cared for, where everything in your life depends upon you and your family. A world of scarcity, where if the crops don't come in, your family dies. If you can put yourself in that world, so many things in the book of Ruth will make a lot more sense to you. It's in this world that Ruth has to be very gentle, very delicate in how she asks Boaz, will you be the guy who redeems our family? She does it in this way that we would call circumlocution, an honorific way. Rather than approaching him and confronting him and saying, hey, you're kidding me, why don't you marry me? Which we wouldn't even do that in the U.S. almost always. She goes down in a very discreet way and says, we have nobody. It's actually sort of a, in that world, though it's a desperate act, it's also a beautiful act. So let's watch what happens, verse 7. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man. He turned, and there was a woman lying at his feet. I think I know what startled him. It was a woman lying at his feet. Who are you? He asked. I am your servant Ruth, she said. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family. Let me show you the social custom of the day. Social custom was that family always took care of family. We say that in America, but it's nothing like what it was in the ancient world, where that was all you had. You really had to mean it. But sometimes that sort of social structure was codified into law. Deuteronomy 25 actually does that. So in Deuteronomy 25, the law says that if brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her and fulfill the duty of the brother-in-law to her. That is, he has to take care of her and provide for her for life. And the first son she bears shall carry the name of the dead brother so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. It's actually a beautiful principle. It's called levirate marriage. It's from a Latin term that means brother-in-law. And it's still practiced in some places in the world today. What's being said is the deceased brother has somebody in his name, so his name is not forgotten, and the widow is not neglected. Someone marries her and cares for her for the rest of her life. For us, not living in the late Bronze Age, it might sound frightening and archaic, you know. I'm not sure which brother Julie would like to marry her in the event that I passed away, but she's right now she's indicating that it would be a toss-up between all of them. In case y'all are watching, I'll let y'all fight that out, boys. To us, it's a frightening prospect, but again, you have to have the imagination of what it must have been like in a world of scarcity. It was a very different world, and Ruth and Naomi's prospects were not very good. So they've gone to a man of means, in fact, and they've just said, will you be the guy? Let's keep reading. Verse 10. The Lord bless you, my daughter, he replied. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All the people of my town know that you're a woman of noble character. This is just a reinforcement of the fact that nothing sinful is going on here. This is not a proposition for something sinful. Although it is true that I am a guardian redeemer of our family, that's our word, there is another who is more closely related than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to do his duty as your guardian redeemer, good, let him redeem you. But if he's not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. you just kind of wonder what all is going on behind the text there. I can't help but think that Boaz realizes this is a pretty good deal, that he likes Ruth. It's a good deal that she's got someone who's willing to protect her, and he has someone that he's attracted to, that he likes. Lie here until the morning. So she lay at his feet until the morning, but got up before anyone could be recognized. And he said, no one must know that a woman came to the threshing floor. See, they're protecting their integrity, as they should. And he also said, bring me the shawl you are wearing and hold it out. When she did so, he poured into it 6 measures of barley and placed the bundle on her. Then he went back to town. So I just can imagine this scene. He has her now pulling out her shawl. He takes 6 measures of barley. I'm not real sure what the measure is here. It's the same in Hebrew as in English. That is, it's a generic measurement. In the shack, he pours the grain in the shawl and sends her on her way. So I told the first service, this is the first version of a shawl shack redemption that I've ever seen. My whole family said, don't do that. Don't. But you can see I can't help myself sometimes. I got cancer, and sometimes that just happens. I shouldn't do that either, should I? When Ruth came to her mother-in-law, Naomi asked, how did it go, my daughter? Then she told her everything Boaz had done for her and added, he gave me these 6 measures of barley, saying, don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Naomi shows her wisdom in the next verse. And we're done after this one. This is kind of my favorite verse in the section. Wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens, for the man will not rest until the matter is settled today. And she was right about that, which is next week's lesson. So here's what I want to do. I just want to reinforce that for each of us, God has offered his redemption. What is redemption in this case? God has offered to pay the price to make things right in our lives. When we couldn't pay the price, when there was nothing we could do to make it right, sometimes our relationships, our lives, our failures or our sins are so entangled that there is simply no sword available to cut that Gordian knot. And then a Redeemer steps in and says, here, I'll pay the price. I'll do what's necessary to make this thing right. Some years back, I met a couple down from Chattanooga. They did an inner city ministry in Chattanooga. They literally moved to the inner city so that their house could be the ministry to the children who were living there, children who just were disadvantaged in every way. And when you ask the question why they did it, their answer was, we both grew up here. The man said that he grew up there, said, he was one of 5 kids to a single mother. I never remember as a family going out to eat. You know, every Father's Day, we had no idea what to do with that. I didn't have a man to tell me how to be a husband. When they got married, he and his wife, he said, I was a terrible man. I had multiple affairs. He had a job at UPS, a good paying job, but he started dealing drugs because he got more money that way, and he eventually went to prison. His wife divorced him. And while he was in prison, he was thinking, there's nothing, he fell back in love with his wife. What can I possibly do to redeem that which is broken? I mean, is there any way to win her love back? You know, in a lot of ways, the answer to that is no. Sometimes you can so mistreat a spouse that it just seems impossible to make things right. Or some relationships seem so broken that they just feel hopeless. Into that world, Christians will say, all right, it's going to be expensive. It's going to cost me a lot. It may be filled with a lot of pain. There's a lot of risk because there's no guarantee it'll work. But I will pay the price to make this marriage right. I'll absorb whatever was done. I won't ask for a forgiveness or an apology. I'm not going to go down that route. What I'm going to do instead is I'm just going to accept you. I'm going to love you, and we're going to say, it's bought back, it's redeemed. That's actually what Christians do. That really should be the distinguishing mark between Christians and people of all other religions. Other religions talk about forgiveness and kindness. It's not just a Christian thing. But Christianity alone says we've been redeemed, and now we go forth, and we offer redemption. Amen. Our man came to know Jesus while he was in prison. When he came out of prison, he decided there was nothing he could do to get his wife back, but he could follow Jesus, and he could serve the kids in the inner city. And by so doing, he said, I can at least redeem all the hurt that I inflicted on my wife and my children those years. And he came out, he led a men's Bible study, became involved in local ministry, as I said. Whenever he did a job interview, he would tell them up front about his drug dealing days and his 10-year sentence in prison. In fact, it took him 9 months to get a job because he was being honest with everybody. But eventually he got a job. And eventually his wife from a distance began to notice him. And she kind of liked this new guy. In fact, she had prayed when she divorced him. She had prayed that he would die. She was so angry with him. And then she decided one day, well, he did die. The old guy did. And they got married. So they originally married on August 28, 1984. They got married 8 years later, also on August 28, this time the year 1984, 1992. And that's when they moved down. And now they can say, you know, our anniversary, pick a date. We've had two anniversaries. But what they learned was that sometimes somebody just has to pay a price in order to restore the rightness of a relationship. I read an article a while back about a young woman who had an abortion down in Miami. She had an abortion at a clinic in Miami that was owned by her boyfriend who got her pregnant and her mother. So she had actually worked in the abortion clinic with her mother. When she got pregnant, both her mother and her boyfriend pressured her into getting this abortion. She said up until that time, though the place was dingy and the walls were painted army green, and there wasn't a lot of joy in there, she had never really noticed what a terrible place it was, an abortion clinic, until she had an abortion. She talked about the physical pain and the humiliation of going through it. And then she said when she came out, she felt guilty. And her guilt stayed with her for decades. She moved away to Texas and she became a Christian. In 2003, she moved back to Miami, and she would drive by that building that was now empty and stop and pray, "Dear God, forgive me." She was still struggling with it. And then this little miracle happened. A ministry called Heartbeat of Miami bought the building. Heartbeat of Miami is a pro-life crisis pregnancy center. They bought the building that had once been an abortion clinic. They painted the walls bright. They set teddy bears out. Suddenly it was a place billowing with life. And as women would come in, these women would get good biblical coaching. They would get supplies and resources that they needed. If they wanted to raise their children, this facility would help them do that. If they wanted to put their children up for adoption, this facility would help them do that. And when the facility there in the old abortion clinic opened, the owners of the ministry called her and asked her if she would be willing to be the manager of this new center. I want to read to you what she said, because what she said just said a lot about redemption. She said it was a gift of redemption. Her name was Jean Pernia. It was a gift of redemption given me by Jesus that day after day I could witness firsthand and share tears with women of all ages as they hesitantly turned their heads towards the monitor and watched the small baby inside of them move. As I held their hands through the sonograms and counseling sessions, piece by piece, my heart was restored. It was an act of redemption that allowed her to overcome the pain of what she had done. Now, Heartbeat of Miami, which has four centers, by the way, this was the second center, has rescued more than 30,000 babies. It's an act of redemption. I just want you to see, sometimes we Christians have to look into a situation that's very painful for us, and one that feels hopeless, or one that just, as I say, it's just a Gordian knot, so thick and so intertwined that there just appears to be nothing that can be done. There's no viable way to get to forgiveness. There seems to be no price that can be paid that will rescue this. Sometimes we Christians have to be the ones to step up and say, I'm willing to pay the price. I'm the one who will step up and make this right. And oftentimes that starts at home. It means having the courage at home when things are very difficult to say, okay, I'll fix it. I'll make it right. And it's painful to do. It is humiliating. It's exhausting. It's very risky because often it doesn't work. The other person doesn't want it. They reject it. And then it just hurts. But don't you think God felt that? Think about God and his role. He sees us full of sin. And he sends his son down to offer redemption for every single human. And how many humans have said, no thanks, I like it my way? I mean, God was willing to take that risk. Shouldn't we be willing to take that risk? One other story. Peter Okoth was raised in a tribe in the western part of Kenya. It was an animist tribe. That is, they worship their ancestors. The thing about ancestor worship is it's actually demon worship, and the demons are real, so they really do things. And if you fail to appease the ancestors in villages like this, you will pay. The demons will come after you. His father was the village chief and the chief of their tribe, which means that his father was in charge of the sacrifices to these demons. Okoth at 22 began to hear the name Isa, or Jesus. He began to become interested in Jesus and to ask around. And it was such a shame for his father that his father decided the only way to preserve his father's integrity was to kill him. So he had 6 men in the tribe take his own son, Peter, out of the town. They wrapped him up in chains, and a witch doctor came with a syringe that was designed for horses, filled with poison. They bound him, put him in a shallow grave, and shot him full of the poison, and walked away, leaving him to die. 3 days he lay in this grave, but he didn't die. And when he woke up, he realized that he should have died, and he also realized that if they catch him, he will die. So he crawled away, and he went quite a ways off from this village. But while he was gone, he found someone who knew about World Bible School. North Boulevard has been doing World Bible School for years. And he began to do a World Bible School with someone here in the U.S., and he learned all about this Isa he had been hearing about. And he finally decided, I want to be one of those. I want to be like him. He was baptized a Christian, and he was so convinced that Jesus is who he says he is that he began to bring his Muslim and animist friends. Eventually, Okoth was so effective at evangelism that he planted 300 churches. By the way, it's a Church of Christ guy. In all of that, there was one thing he couldn't forget. You know what it was, don't you? His own father. And he knew he had to go back. He knew he had to take the gospel to his own village. So after some years, he mustered the courage to go back to his own village. Well, I remind you, they all thought he was dead. It turns out that coming back to a village when everyone thinks you are dead is a good way to get them to listen to you. Because when he got there, they thought he was a ghost, and he said, I need to tell you something about what happens when you die. And they were all really willing to listen. He eventually baptized half the village, but here was the best part. He preached the gospel once with the village chief, his father, standing there, who had tried to kill him. And he looked him in the eyes and he said, this Jesus loves you too. And he had the pleasure of baptizing his own father. You see, that's redemption, the willingness to go back and face death, to face the hardship for the purpose of making something broken into something whole again. This is the hardest of the Christian ethics, I think. It's the hardest one. The one that says, you know, what you did is so stupid, or you are just so hard to love, or it's so painful and you're not even sorry for it. But I'm willing to pay the price because God is a redeemer, so I'm going to be one too. That's the ethic of the book of Ruth. Since God redeems, we do too. So I want you to take that with you, because the holiday season's when you probably most need to hear that message, right? When family comes around and they're the most irritating people, that's when you need to be able to say, God redeemed me, and now I'm willing to redeem you. Let's stand up and we'll sing.